They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. With apologies to the cinematic purists among you, I've been thinking about this one all day.
If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris.
Or maybe we won't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 31st of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two items with which to begin the program on this Wednesday. Item one, ExxonMobil. Today, shareholders in the world's biggest publicly traded oil company overwhelmingly approved a non-binding proposal on climate change, asking management to tally up what global warming might mean for the bottom line, how low-carbon policies would affect Exxon profits, in other words. Item two, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who said on Twitter today after calling the White House that if President Trump ignores his advice and the advice of dozens of other CEOs in this economy and pulls the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, as he has threatened to do, Musk would leave the White House business advisory councils on which he sits. So while we wait for the president to say what he is going to do about Paris, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going with a look at why businesses are still planning for a low-carbon economy no matter what Trump does.
Earlier this month, the CEOs of 30 companies issued an open letter to President Trump expressing their strong support for the U.S. remaining in the Paris Climate Agreement. Some big names signed it: Dow, Procter & Gamble. Regardless of what President Trump does, these companies and many others are moving away from fossil fuels, have been for years. But Matthew Norden with clean energy developer MNL Partners says that's not enough.
I think it's really hard to envision voluntary business commitment alone getting you anywhere near where you need to be to avoid disastrous effects of climate change.
Norden also says some of the biggest polluters, including power and transportation companies, are not entirely on board. He says power companies have to make short-term decisions. How much should they invest in renewable energy or to reopen a coal-fired power plant? He says a decision like that has to please shareholders.
It's made depending on whether they feel like they have the wind at their backs.
Whether the U.S. government is doing things like backing out of the Paris Agreement. But how much does the Paris Agreement matter ultimately? Not much, if you ask Bob Litterman at the New York investment firm Kepos Capital.
It was all the countries of the world getting together and saying, we recognize we have to move together on this. But it didn't have any binding impact on any individual country.
Besides, Litterman says, President Trump's successor can always bring the U.S. back into the Paris Agreement. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs finds itself on the horns of a dilemma thanks to the collapse of the Venezuelan economy. Goldman bought almost $3 billion worth of Venezuelan bonds issued by the state-owned oil company in Caracas through, Goldman says, and this is important, a broker. Goldman got a deal, too, paying 31 cents on the dollar, meaning it stands to profit handsomely from those bonds. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on here.
Venezuela as a country is in very deep trouble right now. Its economy and politics are in tatters.
There's lack of medicine, lack of food. Literally, Venezuelans are losing weight because of hunger.
Bruce Bagley is professor of international studies at the University of Miami. Dozens of protesters have been killed by police. Elections have been postponed. The opposition and many outside observers blame the increasingly autocratic Venezuelan government for the situation.
Political incompetence, venality, and corruption.
That regime, desperate and running out of money, decided to sell bonds at a huge discount, basically 69% off. Goldman Sachs saw a deal and paid $865 million.
They're going to make over $2 billion in profits at a high risk, admittedly.
Moises Naim is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Goldman is being accused, therefore, of supporting the regime.
They are throwing a lifeline to a government that is currently brutally repressing people.
Goldman, in a statement, said that it bought the bonds because it believes in Venezuela's future, and that it bought them on the open market through a broker, and that it did not contribute money to the Venezuelan government.
It's truthful, but not really accurate.
Russ Dallin, managing partner at Caracas Capital Markets, says that Goldman bought the bonds from a thinly veiled front for the government, and that the government did profit.
We watched the central bank cash flows. The money showed up, the $865 million showed up in Venezuela's central bank on the same day.
Goldman, he says, should have known better. The question comes down to what one believes is Goldman's responsibility, to make money or to take stands. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
As if things weren't already lousy enough in brick-and-mortar retail, here's another blow. The high-end retailer Michael Kors said today it's going to close as many as 125 of its full-priced stores as we all shop online and try to avoid paying top dollar as we do it. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Michael Kors CEO John Idol announced the store closures in today's earnings call. He acknowledged that the in-store experience needs a bit more sparkle. Or in his words, Kors needs to
further enhance our store experience in order to better engage and excite consumers.
Like most of retail, Michael Kors has been hit by lagging sales and dwindling foot traffic as more shoppers buy online. But the brand's also struggled to sell its handbags at full price because shoppers have gotten used to serious discounts at department stores and competitors. Milton Pedraza is CEO of market research firm The Luxury Institute.
This is just an indication that the market is so competitive and that Michael Kors is so undifferentiated at this point that they have to compete on price and that obviously they're losing some of the battles.
Michael Kors says it expects to save $60 million a year as a result of the closings. The move is a part of a larger downsizing that's happening across the board in retail, especially among department stores. But retail strategist Carol Speakerman says the closures could hurt awareness of the luxury brand.
If you prune too many stores, you run the risk of lowering awareness, and that can translate into actually fewer conversions in the digital space as well.
Michael Kors operated more than 800 stores as of last month, but only some of those are full price. The company didn't say how many jobs might be lost as a result of the closures, which will happen over the next 2 years. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, another snoozer in the markets. Don't know what to tell you. We will have the details, though, when we do the numbers. With the president back in Washington tending to domestic affairs, we're going to keep our eye on the global economic ball here for just a bit and try to get a sense of where this country's trading relationships might be headed in the wake of a trip that the latter stages of which, anyway, the ones involving NATO and the G7, were a little bit rough. Stephen Gross is an assistant professor of history at New York University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, your take on the president's trip. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it raised a lot of concern in Europe. You know, from the European standpoint, Angela Merkel and other European leaders saw it as, you know, a problematic trip. And I think it raises a lot more questions than it settles.
There's an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, dropped last night. It's in the paper this morning. I'd like to read it to you. It's by H.R. McMaster, the president's national security advisor, also Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council. Talking about the president's trip, and I want to read you some of it and then get your thoughts. First of all, this sentence. The president embarked on his first foreign trip with a clear-eyed outlook that the world is not a global community but an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and businesses engage and compete for advantage. How do you think that's being read in Europe and around the world?
I think that does not dovetail with the way most European leaders, especially German leaders, see the global community. They really stress the cooperative nature of global relationships, and they tend to see the world more as a place of mutual benefit and less as a place of zero-sum competition. So I think that this is not really the way that, in particular, Angela Merkel sees the world, in particular in the way that they see economics and trade.
So as we go forward in this country with the president's America First agenda, what does this bode then for how we're going to conduct trade and, more importantly, how foreign countries are going to look at us when we go to the table and say, listen, let's negotiate this stuff?
Well, I think it's going to bring a more combative atmosphere. I don't know how it couldn't, in the sense that if one actively approaches economic negotiations as a benefit for you or a win for you and a loss for your competitor, that really frames the way people understand the negotiation. And I think there are a lot of potential areas of negotiation out there where the Europeans see things in a very different manner. And I think bringing a different philosophy is going to lead to more intense negotiation over these things.
Is this a document, this op-ed, then, do you think? Is it for the international community or is it for the president's base here at home?
It's for the president's base here at home. McMaster ends with a paragraph where he says, America First signals the restoration of American leadership. And that, I think, is a way for the administration to try and pivot and change the meaning of a main message of the primary campaign. That's not how the Europeans would read it. That's clearly shown or demonstrated in the way that Merkel has reacted and said that the Europeans now have to expect to go it more alone, mm-hmm. which is a big change in attitude, I think. And that sentence in particular struck me as something that is geared towards the domestic audience here in America and not for the European audience.
Well, let me read it to you. The last sentence says, America First means using the diplomatic, economic, and military resource of the U.S. to enhance American security, promote American prosperity, and extend American influence around the world. Why would anybody join with us if what we explicitly are looking for is not a global community, but rather the advancement of only American interests?
I mean, that's a good question, and I really don't have an answer for why people would find this message to resonate overseas.
Stephen Gross is an assistant professor of history at New York University, also at the Center for European and Mediterranean Studies at NYU. Professor, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
There are plus or minus 1,200 jobs in political Washington that are what are known as Senate confirmable positions. The president nominates, the Senate usually confirms. About 500 of them are biggies, essential to the proper functioning of the gears of government, undersecretary of this, commissioner of that, those kinds of things. As of the latest tally by the Washington Post and the Partnership for Public Service, 442 of those positions have nobody nominated to fill them. But this is not a story about those vacancies. It is instead the story of a little-known but highly influential agency known as FERC, F-E-R-C. It regulates electricity markets and oil pipelines, among other things. And lo and behold, it does have nominees. Marketplace's Jed Kim has the story from the Sustainability Desk.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission needs at least 3 of its 5 seats filled to be able to make big decisions. For the past 4 months, it's only had 2 people. And guess what? One of those announced she's stepping down soon. What for the FERC does that mean? Well, with only 2 out of 5 seats currently filled, new energy projects that need federal approval can't move forward. Tony Clark was a FERC commissioner until October.
When it comes to new applications, new filings, major actions, it basically puts a halt to all of those kinds of things. And so it has an impact on really the entire energy industry.
Especially on natural gas. Robin Rorick is with the American Petroleum Institute.
There's almost $15 billion worth of projects that are on hold right now.
Rorick says the longer it takes to get more commissioners, the worse it is for energy companies.
This is a long process. When companies are developing pipelines, they're planning 2, 3, 4, 5 years out in advance. So at any point that there is a hiccup or a block in that process, it pushes those projects further out.
But for people who oppose pipelines, the delays have been welcome. David Delvecchio is mayor of Lambertville, New Jersey. He's against plans for the Penn East natural gas pipeline.
The pipeline route actually goes right through our water system.
The 120-mile route would cut between a dam and a filtration system that provides the city's drinking water. As approval for the pipeline has been stymied, city officials have used the time to set up meetings with Senator Cory Booker, U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials, and community groups.
We just got as many people to intervene and to oppose it and to comment on it as possible.
The FERC, and thus the pipeline plans, could get going again by June. Two commission nominees are making their way through Senate confirmation, though not without opposition.
Shut FERC down! FERC hurts families!
Protesters interrupted confirmation hearings last week, saying the FERC too easily rubber stamps oil and gas projects without consideration for climate change. The FERC has typically been non-political. The two current Republican nominees are Neil Chatterjee, an advisor to Senator Mitch McConnell, and Rob Powelson, a former Pennsylvania utility commissioner. They both understand the role of the commission, says John Moore. He directs the Sustainable FERC project for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
We can work with these nominees, and we think that the value of working with them outweighs whatever benefit we would get from opposing them.
He says part of that work will be reminding commissioners to consider clean energy as they decide what's best for the public whenever they get the FERC going again. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's a little intimidating at the world's busiest airport, for sure.
Little drones, big runways. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 20 points today, about a 10%, finished at 21,008. NASDAQ off 4 points, less than a tenth, 6,198. S&P 500 down a point, flat, 24 and 11. Told you earlier about Michael Kors closing a chunk of its retail stores. Stock sank 8.5%. Today, other fashion stocks, G3 Apparel, which hold the licenses on Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger, down about 1%. Today, energy stocks, pretty much down amid all the talk of the U.S. pulling out of the whole Paris climate change thing. Exxon, down 0.7%. Chevron spilled about 0.5% or so. Bonds flat. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked a little bit about corporate uncertainty up the top of the program. Businesses trying to figure out what's what with the Trump administration and specifically today the Paris Climate Accords. But that is far from the only policy area that's in flux. Take just, for instance, immigration regulations and court injunctions and all the back and forth over who's allowed into the United States from what country and under what conditions. The Trump administration has, under court order, resumed processing refugee applications. But the back and forth has led to delays and, here's that word again, uncertainty for the nonprofits and charities that do that kind of work. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
It's 9:30 in the morning. In this classroom in Buffalo, New York, that means it's time for English. There's a whiteboard with today's lesson written in black marker at the front of the room.
This one is a special one. It's about opposites. What are opposites?
Different.
Right.
Students are bent over desks, focused, but the fingers gripping pens so tightly belong to adults. These students are refugees from countries like Somalia, Sudan, and Syria, the kind of immigrants Trump has put sharp limits on. Marlene Schillinger is with Jewish Family Services, which hosts the classes. She says her job has become extra challenging.
People are always stressed. I'm stressed.
The organization makes ends meet with grants and local fundraising, but most of its money comes from the federal government, $900 per refugee to cover costs for 90 days. That money has to keep classroom lights on and pay staff to do everything from picking refugees up at the airport to teaching them how to write checks. But less refugees means less funding. So while the staff here is normally focused on others, now Schillinger has to talk to them about their own worries.
We're going to do everything we can to maintain this program. We're going to do everything that we can to maintain your livelihood.
Schillinger is trying to cope. shuffling workers around to jobs not connected with resettlement. But some of the staff here are former refugees themselves. For them, Trump's executive order represents a double whammy.
They have families that are still in their countries of origin. They don't know if they're going to be able to get here or not. They don't know if a bomb's going to be falling on their heads.
Yes, the cap has been reset back to 110,000. But Schillinger says once the pipeline shuts down, it's hard to get it running again. Flights need to be rebooked and paperwork revised. She says she may not get more refugees in Buffalo until October or even next year. And many nonprofits that receive federal funding are struggling. Church World Services, which has offices around the world, laid off almost half its staff, more than 400 workers. Now it has plans to rehire, but not that many. Jim Sutton is with Rochester Regional Health in New York. He says even if fewer refugees continue to come in, the cost to care for the ones already here will grow. Just take a Somali patient he saw a couple of weeks ago.
That had actually been here for a couple years and was really stable.
Sutton says he was working as a janitor, doing well. But then the patient started complaining about headaches and trouble sleeping at night.
It was just basically anxiety over what he was seeing on the nightly news that was leading him to come into the doctor's office.
Hans van der Veerd is with the International Rescue Committee. Last year, it resettled more than 13,000 refugees in the U.S. He says since the election, there has been an increase in hate speech. Even kids are getting harassed in school. So, he says, new funding is needed to teach refugees their rights.
That you actually can go to law enforcement and you can actually demand for protection.
Van der Veerd says there is one plus, a silver lining to this mess. Thousands of volunteers are stepping up. Lawyers offering to help refugees stuck at airports, teachers with ESL classes, and individuals are writing checks. But nonprofits still need to take care of their workers. Jim Sutton runs a program for his. It reminds employees not to get too deeply involved in refugees' lives, not to step into the darkness. After all, their own futures are uncertain enough. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This will be small solace to those of you just off a terrible flight delay or those of you about to have one, for that matter. But Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, the busiest in the world, is using the latest in aviation technology to help you get on your way as soon as possible. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Sam Whitehead reports.
Jetliners fire up their engines and roar down runway 27R at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. Air traffic control is in a bit of a rush. The airport's longest runway is about to close to all traffic for maintenance. Well, almost all traffic. A small drone lifts off and zips back and forth across the pavement, snapping pictures. Those will become computer models of the runway, which is slated for repairs. Haim Van Pryon is overseeing the project for Hartsfield-Jackson.
This will allow us to 3D map image the runway and be able to see detailed cracks and be able to plan better for replacing the runways.
Normally, this work happens on foot. Teams armed with cameras walk the runways to assess wear and tear. That process can take up to 5 hours. Van Pryon says a drone can finish in half that time, which has a big upside.
Keeping our runways open longer, the more that we can have our airfield open for aircraft to land and take off, the more efficient that we can be and less impactful for the airspace.
And that means fewer delays for passengers.
You're drifting to the right a little bit.
Katie Elam is an aviation planner for Michael Baker International, the company working with Hartsfield-Jackson on the project. It's her job to make sure nothing interferes with the drone's flight.
The airfield out here is so controlled that I'm not worried about other aircraft being in our area, so it's more about the wildlife.
Her team uses a drone from Chinese manufacturer DJI. You can buy one for just a few $1,000s. Jim Duguay is the pilot.
It's a little intimidating at the world's busiest airport, for sure. But air traffic control has done a good job of moving all the traffic away, and it's a good bright day to capture data.
All this is pretty new. The Federal Aviation Administration just recently approved drone use in the airspace around major U.S. airports. That makes the Atlanta drone flight a pretty big deal, says Jim Williams. He works with unmanned aircraft for the consulting firm Dentons.
I think that going forward, you'll see more of that as the FAA gets more comfortable with controlled drone operations in and around airports.
Tim Canal is president of the Airline Pilots Association and flies for Delta Airlines.
This is the expansion of new technology to help our economy. So overall, it's a good thing.
Canal says drones will be better at spotting problems with runways. That will make flying safer. And their efficiency will mean more time in the sky for his pilots.
Now, that's all said with the caveat that it has to be done in a safe manner. The FAA has worked hard to put mitigations in place for these commercial operations that make them safe.
Still, Canal says it might take airline passengers time to adapt. And inside Hartsfield-Jackson South Terminal, traveler Gail Walton says she'd be pretty concerned if she looked out her airplane window and saw a drone.
I would probably wonder what it was doing out there. I'd probably ring my call bell, ask one of the flight attendants what it was.
It's a question flight crews will likely hear more in the future. The FAA has already okayed more than 500 commercial drone operations around the country's busiest airports. In Atlanta, I'm Sam Whitehead for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of, I don't think you're doing this right, man. Arby's, the fast food restaurant, has become the first ever official restaurant of the PGA Tour, professional golf. Said the company's chief marketing officer, Rob Lynch, today, quote, "We don't have the budget to throw our logo all over the place, but this will make people look twice, so we think it's both ludicrous and awesome that we pulled this off." All right. All right, we got to go. Basically flat all the way across the board, a 10% down on pretty much all of them. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charleston Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.